the one who'd been rifling through her office. Her outrage grew as she inched up the ladder, throwing one arm over the rim, about to pull herself up and out. That was when she felt the cold muzzle of the pistol jammed into the nape of her neck.
"Get up," said the voice behind her.
She did so slowly.
"Hands on your head."
Again, she did as she was told. The fighting stopped. The gunman at her back shouted for everyone to hear.
"Drop your weapons and step into the light, or I blow her head off."
He moved around her, watching as first Jennifer, then Simmons, and then, reluctantly, Regis, complied. The driver was dead. Tamika saw the man who had his pistol trained on her, and knew him immediately.
"Get around, don't you, Miss Mars?" said Cook.
The man who'd hunted her on the streets of Manhattan. The man she had evaded with a quick change of clothes and a lot of nerve. Neither option was available to her now. 67. Jennifer. Indian Springs Auxiliary Field, Number 1. Closed. Nevada. Jennifer knew they were. What was the phrase? Dead men walking. Tamika knew it too. She could see it in her eyes as they were huddled together facing the muzzles of the Maynard Consortium's hired guns, as directed by Salzburg and Manning. She wondered now if Latrange, or Marat as Regis knew him, had been assigned to kill her the day of the disastrous Maynard board meeting, as he'd almost certainly killed her father. He'd underscored the aerospace item on her agenda, leaving her a clue to follow, to see what she already knew, what breadcrumbs her father might have left for her, and the extent to which he was betraying the consortium. She had been set up, decoyed into thinking she was making progress, when in fact, she was just being used to test the consortium's security. As soon as it appeared she had indeed unearthed some damaging truths, she had to be eliminated. But here she was, not dead yet. Not quite. "Hermann Salzburg," she snarled as he came in close, his death's head leer plastered across his loathsome face. "I always hated you."
"Amazingly enough," said Salzburg pleasantly, "I surmised as much. You'll be disappointed to know your feelings did not upset me. Quite the contrary, in fact."
"I'll bet," she said.
She was still scared. But the imminence of her own death had given her a kind of clarity. The blind, trembling terror she had felt during the firefight was gone. The fear was there, but it had been surpassed by the rage she felt, and the revulsion, seeing Salzburg's sepulchral face.
"I will spare you the villain's self-explanations," he said. "You have something I want. Give it to me."
"I don't know what you're talking about," said Jennifer.
"An item you've been directed to by a Polish Jew," said Salzburg, with disgust. "It was not his to give away."
"I don't have it," said Jennifer, "and if I did, I wouldn't give it to the man who arranged the death of my father."
"Arranged?" said Salzburg, amused. "I assume it was you who set Latrange, or whatever his real name is, on my father."
"Oh, no," said Salzburg,
his skeletal grin stretching wider than ever.
"Latrange was otherwise occupied at the time. I took care of that little matter myself."
Jennifer took a breath, fighting back the tears.
"Now," he said, pleased by her response, "the object the plucky Miss Mars has been pursuing, please."
"I told you," she managed. "I don't have it."
Salzburg's expression did not change, and his eyes never left her face, as he raised his voice fractionally.
"Mr. Cook," he said, "kill Miss Mars, please."
Cook pointed his gun squarely at Tamika's chest. 68. Allen. Low Earth Orbit. If the disk's apparent transparency had been strange in the lower reaches of the atmosphere, it was positively surreal in low Earth orbit. As Allen left the world behind him and emerged in the silent blackness of space, just a man in a chair, or so it seemed, moving without support, or protection. He had to fight the impulse to hold his breath. He'd been apprehensive about taking the disk this high. Something Morant had surely guessed, because he had no idea how or if it would perform in the near vacuum that was home only to satellites and potentially lethal debris. Crossing from the lower atmosphere momentarily obscured his sensors as he realized, with a heart-stopping shudder that rippled through the disk's trajectory, that he'd lost Morant's locust. He wheeled around, using his eyes as much as the ship's sensory array, and saw only blackness and the asymmetrical hulks of satellites. He rotated the disk in every direction, feeling the ship's various scanning devices gradually turning back on as the craft adjusted to its new environment. Something lit up, a spot above Alan's right shoulder. He pivoted the disk to see, but there was only an ungainly satellite that looked like something from a junkyard bolted together, sprouting a single bluish solar panel rimmed with gold. He adjusted the disk, scanning a patch of space that seemed smeared by a cloud-like patch of tiny fragments. He slowly spun the disk towards it and set it in motion, making a cautious approach just a little faster than the speed at which the debris was orbiting the planet below. He didn't see Morant's ship emerge from behind the satellite where it had been hidden until it was out in shooting. The disk shot to the right, entering an upward diagonal spiral, followed by a deep dive and a slanting lateral slide. It was barely conscious. The saucer was reacting to Alan's instincts rather than his thoughts, as if man and ship had fused together. The movement was all speed and evasion, without caution, and it was only by chance that it didn't hit any of the space trash floating about. It was the spatial effect of panic. And when Alan drew the disk back into conscious control, he realized he had no idea how far he'd moved. Morant was gone again. The residual energy signature of his locust indicated he'd shot back down toward the lower atmosphere. "What's his trajectory?" Alan said aloud, fighting with his flagging concentration. "Where is he headed?" The ship's computer, not entirely separate from Alan's own overworked brain, sorted through the data and projected a flight path in front of him. Alan blinked. That couldn't be right. "He's returning to Dreamland?" he said. "Why would he do that?" He paused. "Are there other ships with him? Other arrowheads? Bogies?" The invisible screen in front of him became a radar map, and on it glowed the little sparks representing hostile craft, dozens of them converging on Nevada. "Major?" came Reardon's voice. He sounded brighter, but confused. "The enemy's broken off their attack. They're leaving the silos. Not sure what you guys did up there, but I guess we won." Alan did not relax. He stared at the pattern of markers streaking across his viewer. "No," he thought. "We haven't won. We've been duped. Again." They didn't want the silos. They never wanted to set off the missiles. They needed something to draw us into the air, to engage us, pick us off one by one. Because what they really want, what they always wanted. The thought froze him cold. "Reardon!" he shouted, taking one hand off the console to wipe the sweat from his face and eyebrows, then slamming it down and heading for Earth as fast as the ship would go. "Reardon, you have incoming! The hostiles are targeting Dreamland! They want the goddamn base!" 69. Tamika. Indian Springs Auxiliary Field, Number 1. Closed. Nevada. It was absurd. She was going to get herself killed. But then, she was going to be killed anyway, so it didn't matter. Tamika had her hands raised. Cook took a step toward her, pistol at chest height, and she smiled. It was a playful, flirty smile, the smile you shoot to someone over the rim of your mojito at a party, before you lead them to the bedroom. Cook's eyes narrowed with confusion, and in that infinitesimal moment of hesitation, She clapped her hands together on either side of the gun, pushing it up and away. It went off with a blast like a cannon, but the muzzle was well clear by then, and her knee was already in his groin. Cook doubled over, and Tamika stamped one heel hard on his foot. At the same moment, she gripped the warm barrel of the gun and twisted it up, tugging until it rotated clean out of his grip. She was dimly aware of Regis's forehead, rocketing hard into the face of the other fake cop. But she heard the man's nose break before he fell. The man Jennifer had called Salzburg fell back in alarm as Tamika came around with the gun. Cook, who'd not gone down entirely, gave her a look of pure hatred and came at her. She fired once. But she heard two shots, not one. For a moment, the night was full of bitter smoke. Cook crumpled, bleeding from his chest. And then Tamika saw the other gun, in the hand of Salzburg, the old guy who looked like the Grim Reaper. As if in a dream, she processed the fact that it was still pointed at her. And then she felt the pain. 70. Jennifer. Indian Springs Auxiliary Field, Number 1. Closed. Nevada. Jennifer swooped at Tamika, who was folding at the knees, blood spilling from the bullet hole in her chest. She caught her before she hit the ground, staring desperately into Tamika's vacant, rolling eyes. She heard a scramble at her back, a flurry of movement that ended with another snap of gunfire. Three, maybe four shots in rapid succession, like peals of thunder. She held Tamika to her, tense, braced for the stab of agony that would mean she'd been hit. But nothing came, and she finally turned. Regis was on one knee, sighting down the pistol he'd taken from the cop he'd headbutted, and Manning was motionless on the ground. Salzburg, who'd been at her back only moments before, had loped away in the confusion, shooting as he made for the gray car. "Stop him!" yelled Jennifer. Regis fired twice, but if he hit the banker, it didn't slow him down. He heard the car engine turn over and the squeal of tires as Salzburg pulled away. Regis stooped to Tamika, snatching up a flashlight and shining it on her wound. It was higher than Jennifer had feared, closer to the shoulder.
"Simmons," he said, "get the med kit out of the Humvee." "Can you look after her?" he added to Jennifer.
"Me?" she answered. "I have no medical training."
Regis frowned, but didn't hesitate, sweeping the flashlight over the other bodies. Manning and the man they had called Cook were both dead. So was the army corporal. The fake cop with the broken nose was unconscious and bloody, but breathing. Regis rolled him onto his belly and used cuffs to secure the man's hands behind his back.
"Stay with her," he said to the soldier with a nod at Tamika. "Clean and dress the wound, then keep pressure on it until the bleeding stops. Give her painkillers and keep her awake until help arrives."
"What about me?"
asked Jennifer.
"You're driving," said Regis,
throwing her the keys to the Humvee and picking up the corporal's fallen rifle. He didn't wait for her response, instead barking into his radio, calling for backup, for a medical team, and for eyes on the road to the disused airfield.
"And put me in touch with Major Young," he roared. "Now!"
71. Allen. Nevada Airspace. Allen didn't know how fast he was going. He was driving the disc to its limit, hurtling through the sky, his vision briefly a fiery red as he re-entered the lower atmosphere, fighting to order his thoughts and prepare for the onslaught that would come. He still had no clear sense of the ship's defensive capacity, whether it had some form of shield or cloaking technology, and though he'd fired its weapons several times now, each one had been subtly different. And he hadn't known why, as if the ship were making choices for him, choices he did not understand and could not process in the split second it took to select a target, prime, and fire. His nerves were ragged. The sweat on his face might have been mixed with tears, if only because he dare not blink for fear of what he might miss. his heart and lungs working at maximum load. But this was minimal, compared to the strain on his mind. It was collapsing under the weight of that constant calculating focus, the mental sifting and arrangement of countless streams of information. He was at the limits of functionality. He had only moments before he would collapse, black out. But there was no one else. Jackson was dead. Rodriguez had gone hunting at the other silos and wouldn't be back until it was too late. It was on him. And suddenly he was there, high above the pale crater of Groom Lake, and before he had time to think, he was in combat range. His viewer was a swarm of arrowheads, and, buried in their midst, a single locust. Marat. Once more, the peeling, shrieking peregrine dive. And once more, the enemy ships scattering like minnows evading a pike. And once more, the flash of laser fire and other stranger weapons. The disc shuddered as it was hit again and again, and suddenly Alan was no longer a chair in space, but a man sealed inside a metal saucer. Whatever allowed him to see through the hull of the ship had shut down or been destroyed, and he was momentarily blinded. He instinctively pulled the disc into a complex evasive climb, zigzagging up and out of the swarm, rotating as he went, and scattering weapons fire in his wake. He was back to the screen viewer now, limiting what he could see in his periphery. But he saw the glare and puff of at least two arrowheads exploding. Triumph, defiance, and bloodlust swam red through his mind as he wheeled the ship, pinioning, ratcheting, leaping back into the fray, targeting one ship, then another, firing as fast as he could think. And with each desperate shot, he felt himself grow weaker, less in control, as if he were firing bolts of his own life force. But then he saw Marat's locust and swept into pursuit, firing half-blind with rage and exhaustion. Whether he was a traitor or imposter didn't matter anymore. Marat was a killer, an enemy combatant. Alan strained to hold on, angling, adjusting, jinking the saucer left and right, as Marat tried to shake him. Alan could feel the other ships tearing toward him at the edge of consciousness, but his anger gave him focus till he could see nothing but Marat's ship. He twisted, dove, rotated, and fired. The moment he got the shot away, Alan gasped with relief. But now the rest were on him, pummeling the disc so that it shuddered and slid first one way and then another, and he could feel the lasers carving into the metal. His craft slewed into a ragged climb, and he lost sight of Marat's locust, all of his attention scanning for the other ships. He must have hit Marat. Surely. Then there was something else. Two pale streaks, like missiles, but not clearly solid, coming right at him. He dropped the disc 1,000 feet in under a second, and one of the streaks shot overhead. The other somehow adjusted, dipped, swerved, and hit him. The disc did not come apart, but it began to roll in the air, such that Alan turned over and over, systems failing, and he was holding on by the edges of his mind as he lost sense of what was happening. Dimly, he remembered the weapon he'd used before when he'd saved Rodriguez, his one achievement for the day, the thing that had sought out the center of their attack, and then burst like a firework, tumbling the enemy to nothing. Perhaps if he could find that, or something like it, something bigger. The thought was dreamy and unspecific. Alan felt himself sliding into something like sleep, and for a second, he thought he was hallucinating the new ship. It was not an arrowhead, and not a locust, and not a silver disc like the craft he was flying. It was something different, spherical and glowing, with a steady orange glow that reminded him of the craft he had seen over the Afghan mountains so very long ago. He didn't know where it had come from or what it was going to do, but he saw the light at its heart focus, and he knew some kind of terrible weapon was coming. With the last of his strength, he muttered, "Fire!" And as the blast radius spread towards the tumbling arrowheads, coursing through them and blowing many of them away like leaves, he careened at full speed into the sphere. 72. Timika, Indian Springs Auxiliary Field, Number 1. Closed. Nevada. Timika opened her eyes and tried to sit up. "Keep still." It was the soldier who had been in the back of the Humvee with them, Simmons. "How long was I out?" she asked as memory rushed in. "Couple of minutes, maybe 5, said Simmons. "Which is it?" "Which is what?" "A couple, which is 2, said Timika, "or 5, which is, you know, longer." 5, said Simmons, irritated. "How do you feel?" "Well, I seem to have this fucking hole in my shoulder. So, you know, been better. Apart from the pain," said Simmons, his patience peeling away like sunburned skin. "Apart from the pain, I feel like I could run a marathon. I couldn't, of course, because I'd die," said Timika, "on account of the pain." "Right," said Simmons. "But your breathing's okay? You don't feel nauseated or like you might pass out again?" "No," said Timika, taking pity on the boy. "I'm okay. Thanks." She looked around. "Where's Jennifer and the officer?" "Took the Humvee to go after that guy." "Skeletor?" "That's the one," said Simmons, grinning in spite of himself. "There's a medical team en route. There's a lot going on at the base, but they'll be here soon." "Good," said Timika. "Wait. No, not good. There's something I have to do." She tried to get to her feet. "I told you to keep still," said Simmons. "You going to shoot me?" she asked. "No, ma'am," said Simmons, chastened. "Then help me out," she said. Simmons sighed, but knew there was no point arguing. He let her use him to get upright, and then escorted her to the manhole. "You can't manage that ladder," he said. "I won't use my right hand," said Timika. It was a concession, but one she knew she had to make. Her shoulder throbbed, and she couldn't raise her arm without excruciating pain. "I gotta stay here with him," said Simmons, nodding at the cuffed and unconscious man in the police uniform. "It's okay. If I need you, I'll holler." She maneuvered herself awkwardly into the shaft and descended, one rung at a time, relying on her left hand, until she reached the bottom. She reached around with her good arm and plucked the flashlight from her right pocket, then approached the open door with the drawer and the box. She considered the metal lid, molded with the square wings of a German eagle. She fumbled with her left hand until the clasps popped, and she opened it to reveal the treasure she'd been chasing for so very long, even now wondering what Jersey Stern could have thought was so important. She gasped. Inside the box was a slab of stone, covered with deeply scored carvings in some language she did not know. It reeked of antiquity. It was, she thought, Old Testament old. Around the rim was set a band of bluish metal, which pulsed and glowed as she moved her hands over it. It was the same material Katerina Lundegrass had shown her, though her piece had been a mere fragment of something her father had picked up long ago at the world's most famous crash site. "You got something?" called Simmons. "Yeah," she breathed. "I got something." 73. Jennifer, Nevada. It was like driving on the rutted back roads of Africa, as if they were rushing to glimpse some nocturnal lion kill, or to outrun a territorial hippo. The four-wheel drive Humvee sped along the road and handled those moments when, as they tried to stay close to the gray car, they sometimes left the road entirely. Salzburg, by contrast, was weaving erratically. "You think he's hit?" Jennifer shouted, shifting down a gear. "Not sure," said Regis. He had braced himself into a precarious kneeling crouch in the rooftop gunport, his head and shoulder exposed. The rifle aimed forward as he tried to get a shot. When she asked if he thought that was safe, he shrugged. "So long as you don't flip the vehicle and cut my damn head off," he said.
"Where the hell is he going?"
Jennifer muttered. The car's taillights showed where Salzburg left the road, pulling hard up a ridge, not unlike those she'd hiked on Hapsos Land earlier in the evening. It would be hard going for a low two-wheel drive vehicle, and she wasn't surprised when the car stopped to redirect, pulling hard up the ridge. In the delay, the Humvee closed the distance between them until they were almost alongside him. It was in that instant that Salzburg risked a shot from the driving seat. Jennifer saw the flash of the pistol, but didn't hear it over the Humvee's engine. And then Regis was returning fire above her, shell casings raining down into the cab and spinning under her feet. Salzburg smashed his way through the desert brush of the ridgeline, but he was on level ground, whereas the Humvee canted dangerously as they ran beside him. One false move, and they really might roll. She risked a glance at Regis as he fired again. And this time, he hit. The flank of the gray sedan, already scuffed and buckled from the drive, was punctured in several places close to the front wheels. Then the tire blew, and the car slewed dangerously, first down their side, then back up and over the ridge, where it buckled against a boulder, careened on two wheels, and finally flipped, rolling down the slope on the other side. Jennifer slowed the Humvee and angled its nose over the ridgeline, and down again, until its lights fell on the mangled wreckage of the other car. She was out and running before Regis could stop her, before she even knew what she would do when she reached the man who'd killed her father, if he had survived the accident. He hadn't. That was instantly apparent. She felt a savage triumph, chased by more complex feelings that she could not put into words. At last, conscious that those strange emotions had settled into a kind of profound relief and closure, she trudged back up to the Humvee, where Regis was shouting into the radio, one hand pressed hard against his ear, as if to wring whatever sound there was from the headset.
"I can barely hear you," he was saying. "What?" "Yes, we're on the ground. I think we can get there. Hold on, Alan."
And then they were driving again. 74. Alan. Nevada airspace. The disc was going down. Hard. So was the sphere. He'd hurtled into it, all weapons blazing. And now his barely conscious mind was telling him that that had been a mistake. He'd targeted the craft because he'd assumed it was part of the hostile fleet, but its weapons had not been locked onto him. He didn't know how he knew that, but he had felt it at the moment of impact, the shrill cry of alarm and surprise that he'd sensed through the metal of the battered disc, until a single awful thought registered, even as he slammed into the sphere's hull. It hadn't come from nowhere. It had come from the base. It was one of ours. Alan fought to track its fall, guiding the saucer as best he could as it lurched haphazardly into its final descent. But his mind was darkening, as if he were sliding into the water in some subterranean cave. "Coming down," he murmured, barely awake. "Sphere, get to that ship." He wasn't sure if Reardon could hear him, or Regis, or anybody. He was really only talking to himself. He watched the sphere struggle, fight to regain its momentum, and fall. As he finally slipped into the dream, his hands slid lifeless from the console, and the disc tumbled from the sky. 75. Jennifer. Nevada. "Coming down," said the spectral voice on the radio, a voice of inexpressible weariness, quite unlike the man Jennifer had bickered with in the bar not so very long ago. "Sphere," the voice said, "get to that ship." "Major," called Regis into the radio, "Alan, can you read?" but the pilot did not reply. Suddenly there was a steady thrumming in the air, rising in pitch and volume, and when she looked up, Jennifer could see the light coming down in a hard, straight line. A ship, not landing, but crashing to earth. "Follow it!" bellowed Regis. Jennifer turned the key in the ignition and set the Humvee lurching down the ridge toward the road. She saw the burst of light, heard the deep, resonant thud of the crash, the echoes trembling in the air over the noise of the Humvee's engine. And then they were speeding along an old, forgotten highway, their eyes fixed on the fiery glow that rose up from behind a ragged line of barren hills. They made for it, though what they would find when they got there, Jennifer could not imagine. 76. Tamika. Indian Springs Auxiliary Field Number 1. Closed. Nevada. The box was too heavy to move, especially with her right arm crossed, painful and useless, against her chest. So Tamika fumbled in her pocket, drew out her cell phone, turned on the flash, and took three pictures of the stone tablet and its curious metal frame. Then she slid the drawer closed, locked the door to the safe, secured the key, and clambered awkwardly back up the desert and the bodies. She was halfway up the ladder when she heard the distant boom, and emerged to find Simmons gazing off to where the sky was lightened by an amber, uneven glow. "Something's crashed," he said, awestruck, barely aware of her. "I saw it come down, right there." As he pointed, the second craft descended. It wasn't lit up, but the whole thing seemed to glow softly, like a ball at the end of a long punt, accelerating as it fell. The impact sounded different, shorter, less booming, but there was still something jarring about it. It shook her from her watchful reverie and sent her running to the white sedan the fake cops had been driving.
"Hey," said Simmons, "you can't take that. You've got to stay here until the med team arrives." "You keep your eye on him," Tamika shot back, pointing to the handcuffed man on the ground and climbing into the driver's seat. The keys were in the ignition. She had to see.
77. Allen, Nevada. Sleep. It felt like sleep, but it wasn't. Not quite. It was a drowsiness that closed his fluttering eyelids and shut down his senses, but his mind still worked. Just. Thoughts reached out, thin and wavering. It felt like trying to move an oak tree by pulling on its outermost branches, his mind straining. Allen, who was no longer Allen, but the broken disc, flexed and dragged, and then the branch was sliding through his fingers, and he was holding nothing, forgetting the metaphor of the tree, of the saucer, just drifting through the blackness of space. The disc struck the earth. It did not bounce, instead blasting a crater that it excavated as it slewed, plowing up rock and dirt and carving its way across the desert floor, glowing hot so that the dry bushes it touched flared with sudden fire and were gone, but slowing, slowing, stopping, all noise ceasing, as if all sound had been sucked out of the night. 78. Jennifer, Nevada. They reached the fractured disc first. Regis sprang from the vehicle, picking his way along the trench the ship had made when it hit the ground, before Jennifer had shut the engine off. She jumped down from the Humvee, slipping where the sandy earth had turned into hard crystalline glass from the heat of the impact. A curved panel that might have been a door had popped off the disc. She directed her flashlight inside, where Regis was unstrapping the man in the chair. Allen. He was unconscious, but amazingly, was not dead. His body was intact, despite the crash. She stepped back to examine it. The saucer appeared to be largely intact,
if battered and bent out of shape. It ticked as it cooled. A handprint, Regis's, had burned onto the side by the hatch. It smoked still. Jennifer approached, feeling the heat of the thing shrinking her hair as she got close. She could smell it smoldering. Careful not to touch the strange metal, she reached into the hatch and helped guide Regis out, taking as much of the pilot's weight as she could manage. Regis's bare arm brushed the edge of the hatchway, and she heard the flesh sear, but he only grimaced and kept working. Once they had him out, they moved him away from the ship and laid him on the ground, where Regis pressed his ear to the pilot's chest.
"Is he alive?"
Regis hesitated.
"I think so, but his pulse is very faint. He's breathing."
As Regis barked into the radio again, Jennifer got back into the Humvee. There was another ship to see. 79. Tamika, Nevada. The white sedan struggled with the terrain the moment she left the road. Tamika drove as fast as she dared. When the big man stepped into her headlights, waving his arms frantically, she swerved to go around him before she realized who it was. The officer called Regis. She skidded into a sliding halt, then reversed when she realized what he wanted. He had a man with him. The man lay slumped on the ground, his head tipped back in an alarming manner. He was wearing a tan flight suit, and for a moment, Tamika thought he was dead.
"Help me get him in the back," said Regis.
Tamika shone her flashlight to where something sparkled and smoked at the end of a deep black trench.
"He was in that?" she gasped. "I'm not sure we should be moving him."
"Sphere," said the pilot, his eyes cracking open a fraction. "Take me to the sphere."
"You heard the major," said Regis.
"What if he has, I don't know, broken bones or internal bleeding?" said Tamika.
"I'm fine," breathed the pilot. "Just tired."
Tamika gaped at him.
"Tired?"
"The craft wasn't breached," said Regis. "He's shaken up, but he's okay. If he says it's important to get to the other ship, that's what we should do, okay?"
Tamika bit her lip, then nodded and pulled open the back door. To her surprise, Regis didn't need her help. The pilot, whose name badge read A. Young, presumably the Alan Jennifer had mentioned, was recovering rapidly, though he still seemed strangely shell-shocked. His eyes were vague and unfocused, but once Regis had him on his feet, he seemed able to stand by himself. Even so, he labored clumsily into the back seat and slouched there, breathing hard, as Tamika got into the driver's seat and pulled away.
"Over there," said Regis.
The underside of the white sedan whined in protest as the car picked its way among the stones and scrub brush. If she wasn't careful, she thought, eyeing a particularly nasty-looking rock, she'd peel open the gas tank like a sardine can.
"Faster," said Regis. "They'll be here soon."
"Who's they?"
she shot back irritably. If he knew the answer, he didn't say, turning over his shoulder to consider Alan, sprawled on the back seat. It wasn't hard to see where the second ship had come down. There was a wide blackened track, part of which still smoked in her high beams, and a few small brush fires. Tamika nosed the car up the side of a ridge, grimacing at the scraping of the underside, and feeling the wheels spin as they tried to get enough purchase on the sand and gravel to haul the vehicle to the top. And then they were tipping over the crest, and the headlights fell on the scene below them. It looked like the sphere had clipped the ridge, then bounced over the downslope before slamming into the next rocky outcrop. There were more scattered fires up here, and a wider swath of scorched undergrowth. Though it had been badly distorted by the impact, the ship had not exploded. It was smaller than the disk, and sat in the blasted ground like the egg of a dragon, sparkling with strange energy. A portion of the outside had been torn away, the source, presumably, of the debris they had been following. and it provided a dark opening into the heart of the craft, as if the egg were hatching. Jennifer was sitting on the ground beside it. The Humvee abandoned halfway down the ridge, its lights blazing. She stared into space, her face creased into a stunned bewilderment that was unnerving to look at.
"You okay?" Tamika demanded, getting out of the car.
The other woman didn't answer. She looked dazed, drugged. Tamika rushed over to her.
"Jennifer," she said, "what is it?"
The Englishwoman seemed to grow slowly aware of her, looking up and focusing. There was dirt and something like oil smeared across her face, but she seemed unaware of anything.
"Jennifer," Tamika said again, "what's wrong?"
Jennifer licked her lips and said simply, "Look." 80. Allen, Nevada. Allen slithered out of the back seat, forcing his legs to work. His body was intact, he was pretty sure. But his mind was still sluggish, and his limbs felt heavy when he moved. He got to his feet on the ground, but as he stood up, the world swam, and he had to steady himself against the car. The sphere was there, a great rupture in one quadrant, though whether he had done that, or if it had been split open by the crash, he didn't know. A surge of nausea rose up in him as he considered the awful probability. Friendly fire. The craft had risen to protect him, and he had taken it down because he hadn't been able to keep his mind focused any longer. He had done this, but he had to be sure. Regis was already scrambling up the ridge toward the sphere, flashlight held out in front of him. Allen saw two women sitting together. Then one of them followed Regis, peering over his shoulder. He needed to know what they saw. There would be insignia, surely. Badges. Identifying marks, so they would know for sure which side they were on. And maybe, just maybe, the crew wasn't dead. He took a cautious step, then another, still clumsy, and then dropped to his hands and knees to make the climb up to the ship. But then Regis was pulling him up and whispering into his face.
"Come on, Major. We gotta go. We can't be here."
"What?" Allen muttered.
"No, I have to see..."
"You don't," said Regis. "You've seen too much already. We all have." Allen shrugged out of his grip and nearly overbalanced, but he spoke with determination.
"No," he said. "I have to know. Was it ours?"
Regis stared at him, his face contorted with emotion. Then he shook his head.
"Thank God."
"Theirs," said Allen. "Hostile." Regis dropped his eyes, then shook his head again. Allen stared at him, trying to understand.
"What do you mean?" he said. "Not ours, Major," said Regis. "Not theirs. Different."
"Different how?" Allen pressed.
"These craft you're flying," said Regis. "Where did we get them?"
"What do you mean?" he said. The two women were staring at them.
"Where did these ships come from?" Regis demanded, his voice raised. "Who built them? What built them?"
Allen opened his mouth to speak, but no words came. And suddenly, the night was full of a familiar and steady droning sound. He saw lights in the sky over the base. Helicopters, coming in fast. Allen took a step towards the down sphere.
"You don't want to look in there," said Regis, pulling him back. "We need to be elsewhere, now."
Allen fought back, but in his present state, he was no match for the big man.
"Get back in the car, Major," said Regis. "We gotta go."
But Allen had to see, and with his last ounce of strength, he worked out of Regis's grasp and stumbled toward the fractured sphere. He looked. He saw. And dimly, inadequately, he understood.
even if what he saw merely confirmed that all he thought he knew before that moment was wrong. They took the Humvee, all four of them piling in and sitting in silence, as Jennifer drove it back toward the road. The helicopters arrived before they made it. Soldiers spilled out, rifles raised, so they stopped and got out, hands on their heads, watching as a pair of dark SUVs came speeding along the road toward them. The men who got out wore black suits and sunglasses. 81. Jennifer, Indian Springs Auxiliary Field, number 1, closed, Nevada. They returned to the abandoned airstrip, where Tamika, in spite of her arm, insisted on being the one to lead the soldiers down the ladder to the three tiny vaults. They looked the same as before, she said. When they came back up, the drawer that had contained the box with the stone tablet held only a laminated information sheet detailing the identifying marks and habitat of a rare breed of fish.
"What the hell is an Ash Meadow speckled dace?" she said.
It was almost funny, Jennifer thought, wiping the dust and filth from her face, thinking about her father and the men who had killed him, about all she had learned, and all the new questions she still had to answer. Almost funny. The soldiers, the medics, and the so-called EPA men had decided to give them some space. They had a lot to explain, they'd been told, but criminal proceedings seemed unlikely, which actually was kind of funny. While the various representatives of officialdom filed reports and documented the scene, and did God knew what else to spirit it all away in the trucks and choppers, Jennifer asked a question.
"What do you think they're talking about?" she said, giving the men in the distance a look.
"Cover stories," said Regis. "The Roswell Protocol. My money's on marsh gas."
"Weather balloon," said Alan, with a bleak smile.
"Definitely weather balloon."
For a moment, they all turned to watch, as men in hazmat suits climbed down from yet another helicopter. The patch of desolate ground, empty of people no more than a couple of hours ago, and for the last 50 years, was starting to look like Piccadilly Circus at rush hour. For a minute or more, the four of them watched.
"So, now what?" said Tamika. Regis shrugged. "They'll take statements," he said. "Get us to sign declarations."
"No," said Tamika.
"I mean, what do we do next? After we leave here, I mean. I had a life, I thought. But it doesn't seem to make much sense now. I think there's stuff I need to do, questions I gotta ask, you know?"
"Yeah," said Jennifer. "I know. I'll be right there with you."
The two women caught each other's eyes and grinned.
"You could probably use a pilot," said Alan.
"Easy there, Captain America," said Tamika. "I'm not sure you're on our side."
"Well," said Alan, "to be honest, neither am I. But I think maybe I am."
Jennifer stared at him.
"Are you serious?" she said.
He seemed to consider this, then nodded.
"I think so," he said. "I spent a lot of time doing what I was told. I've got some questions of my own. What about you, Barry?"
"Barry?" said Tamika. "Who the hell is Barry?"
"Me," said Regis. "I thought your name was Regis, like Regis and Kelly or some shit."
"My name's Barry Regis," said the big man, scowling. "And yeah, I guess I got some questions."
"Well, all right then," said Tamika.
There was a long silence, as a strange and unexpected harmony settled within the group. Off to the east, Jennifer saw a long slash across the horizon that was slowly turning the sky pink.
"Hey, what do you know?" said Tamika thoughtfully. "Sunrise."
And so it was. Though what the new day would bring, Jennifer could not begin to imagine. But, she thought vaguely, at least the night was over.
82. Tamika. Indian Springs Auxiliary Field Number 1, closed, Nevada. Another helicopter arrived,
then a truck, and another couple of Humvees. Last, with a dragging roar that anticipated its arrival by over a minute, came a cement mixer. Tamika had no idea where they got a cement mixer at this time of night, but she had a pretty good idea what they were going to do with it. The vaults at the foot of the concrete shaft had, after all, been emptied already. She took a minute to upload the pictures she had taken to a private Dropbox. It was too much to hope that she'd be allowed to walk away from this with her phone. As to what this was... "This way, please, Miss Mars," said one of the newly arrived soldiers, gesturing toward his Humvee. He was not wearing a name badge. "I think I'd rather stay with my friends," she answered, wondering a little about the ease with which she had said that last word. It wasn't a term she used much, and certainly not to describe people she'd only just met. "I'm afraid that won't be possible," said the soldier. "Interrogation will be separate." "Interrogation?" Tamika shot back. "About what? We should be getting the damn Medal of Honor, or some shit. You have violated numerous security protocols. You trespassed on government property and leaked classified information. And your friends," he continued, nodding at Alan and Barry Regis, "have questions to answer about the death of a special agent."
"What?"
Tamika exclaimed. "They didn't kill anybody. You need to find that Latrange guy, or Marat, or whatever his name is." She spoke with a certainty which, like her use of friends a second ago, made little objective sense, but felt absolutely right. "Mr. Marat is missing and presumed lost," said the soldier. "Now, if you would get into the vehicle, please. I'm authorized to use force if you do not comply." There wasn't much you could say to that, and before she could frame any kind of quip, Tamika's phone rang. She snatched it up before the soldier could stop her.
"Tamika? It's Marvin."
"Thank God," she said.
"Where the hell have you been?" "One of those bogus cops showed up at my place, so I took off. I went to..."
"You can tell me later," she replied. "Right now I need you to get in touch with my lawyer. I'm being held at Area 51 in goddamn Nevada, if you can believe that."
"Dude," said Marvin.
"No way."
"Way," said Tamika, as the soldier reached for her phone. "You need to hang up, ma'am," he said. "Later, Marvin," she said. "We'll be in touch. And Marvin?"
"Yeah?"
"I'm glad you're okay."
She hung up pointedly, staring down the soldier who, unsure of his authority, looked away. Tamika scanned the surreal landscape. The pink desert sand strobed by the brights of half a dozen vehicles, the waiting helicopter kicking up dust in a wide arc as its rotors thrummed steadily. Her gaze found Jennifer, and for a moment, the two women's eyes locked, and Tamika nodded. That was all she needed to do for the Englishwoman to get the message. They'd reconnect, they'd find each other, and they'd make sure the men weren't tagged with some bogus murder charge. This wasn't over. They were just getting started.
83. Alan. Secure Facility, Nevada.
Alan was still groggy from the crash, and from whatever medication he'd been given to stabilize him, and he was pretty sure he had slept through most of the helicopter ride. Even if he had been awake, there would have been no way he could have gauged how far they'd traveled in the blacked-out helo. When they landed, he was immediately blindfolded. He protested, proclaimed his innocence of Hatcher's murder, expressed his drug-fogged outrage that a man of his rank and service record should be treated like this by his own government, but he got no response at all. He was bundled into an open-topped vehicle, driven for a few minutes, then forced out. He was marched inside a cool air-conditioned building that hummed with the white noise speakers he knew from Dreamland. But it didn't feel like he was in Dreamland. He wasn't sure why he thought that. A smell, perhaps. It just felt different. And though he could merely have been taken to some part of the extensive facility he'd never visited before, he didn't think so. He thought there were three men with him, possibly four. One of them left after they rode an elevator, which smelled of new institutional carpet. The elevator was smooth. Alan estimated they descended at least 5 stories. And when they came to a stop, the sound echoed, as if he were in a cave or tunnel, though the surface he walked on was level and hard, concrete, almost certainly. A dull whir rose in pitch and volume, wound down, and then they were getting onto some kind of train. "We going to see Blofeld?" Alan quipped woozily. No response. Maybe not the time for James Bond jokes. They spent maybe 5 minutes on the monorail, or whatever it was. Got off, walked for maybe 3 minutes, took 2 left turns, then waited as a door was unlocked, and he was pushed inside. The door closed, and his blindfold was removed. There were 2 guards on the door, and a man in a suit sitting at a table, with a battered book in front of him. He looked up and nodded Alan into the chair opposite him.
"You can't do this," Alan muttered, trying to sound defiant, but conscious of the way his voice sounded ragged and woolly. He tried to sit up straight, but his body was sagging into a weary slouch in spite of his best efforts. His mind, too. He wanted to sleep for a week.
"Yes, Major Young," said the man at the desk. "We can." He was small, balding, mid-40s, with watery blue eyes. Nondescript. A man you would pass on the street without noticing. A forgettable man, except that Alan had met him before.
"Agent Harvey Kenyon," said Alan. "We met on the plane from Kuwait."
The bald man smiled.
"You have a good memory, Major," he said. "Though names are," he gestured vaguely with his hands, "unreliable." "I saw inside the sphere," Alan said. He felt a strange exhilaration that was overriding his natural caution. "I saw the pilot. You guys have been experimenting, or genetically engineering some kind of..."
His voice tailed off. He couldn't find the words or the conviction.
"Why are you so damn secretive about everything? Why don't you just tell the world what we have, what we can do? You don't even tell your own people. I work for you. I have clearance."
The small man sat back, smiling cryptically, as if he were both puzzled and amused.
"You think this is about clearance?" he said. "Not at all. Or not in the sense that you mean it." "So why am I here?" Alan said, managing to dredge up a little defiance. "You know I didn't kill Hatcher."
The man whom he knew as Kenyon nodded thoughtfully, his eyes falling on the book on the table. It was bound with black leather, or something like it, worn and cracked, and when he flipped it open, its pages were thin as tissue and marked with a slim gold ribbon.
"Tell me, Major," he said absently, "are you religious?"
Alan blinked and tried to focus. Maybe he was already dreaming.
"Not really," he said at last. "Why? What does any of this have to do with religion?"
"Oh," said the bald man, looking up and smiling, a cat-like grin that did not reach his eyes. He pushed the book across the table to where Alan could read the 2 words on its spine.
"Absolutely everything," said the man, tapping the book with his index finger.
The lettering on its spine said, "The Odyssey, by Homer." "Though perhaps myth is a better term than religion.
Less loaded. Major Young, did you ever wonder how the Apollo space program got its name?"
Alan blinked.
"Apollo was the god of the sun, right?" he said. "And crossed the sky daily in a glittering chariot," Kenyon agreed. "So?" "So let's consider the possibility that that chariot was more than metaphorical." "Let me get this straight," said Alan. "You're saying that the craft we're flying was brought here by aliens which humans took to be the gods of ancient Greece, but they left and now we have their stuff?"
In response to Alan's contemptuous tone, Kenyon smiled, but for a moment so long it became uncomfortable. He said nothing, just staring unblinkingly at Alan,
that odd, knowing smile fixed on his nondescript face. At last he opened his mouth. But the next 8 words came out so low that Alan had to strain to hear them. "What makes you think that they ever left?" Afterword. There is no doubt fiction makes a better job of the truth. Doris Lessing. What you just heard is a piece of a very large puzzle. It represents the first installment in one of the most ambitious projects ever undertaken in this or any other field. It is a project that involves science and history, politics and religion, fiction and nonfiction. All of these elements are woven together in an effort to express a singular truth. While they each can be appreciated in a standalone way, and who, after listening to this thrilling novel, could disagree, taken together, they reveal an aspect of reality that is so astonishing that it only can be understood intuitively, as well as rationally. It was Tom DeLonge who conceived of this revolutionary, multidisciplinary approach that includes books, art, music, and film, all as individual facets of a single polished gemstone of revelation. Some truths, as Nobel laureate and science fiction author Doris Lessing reminds us, can best be expressed in fiction. And this is what A.J. Hartley has accomplished spectacularly in this novel. What has been missing in most published accounts of the phenomenon at the heart of human experience is the narration. There are many books on the subject that are vast accumulations of facts, dates, interviews, personal accounts, and declassified documents. They are necessary, but they cannot convey the whole truth. They cannot convey the emotional impact of the experience, which is, after all, its essential characteristic. That is because we have no vocabulary to define it, categorize it, measure it, box it in. All attempts at doing so swing wildly from the dry statistics of a government report to the wide-eyed fanaticism of mystical revelation. The only solution to this problem is a conscious, deliberate juxtaposition of fact and fiction to arrive at a truth that transcends both. A solution represented by what you have just heard. I won't say too much more about this project. Where's the fun in that? You will have to see it for yourself. Watch it unfold. Gradually, as you read both the fiction and the nonfiction, you will find the facts meshing with the narrative. You will see how the one influences the other, and how they both reveal the warm secrets buried beneath the cold snow of official memoranda. Then the art, the music, and the film will expand on the theme, and show it from many different angles. In this, we are going back to the original form of storytelling, what the anthropologists and the archaeologists and the philosophers have told us is myth and fantasy, with their associated arts, music, and drama, but which we understand to be honest efforts by honest people to leave an account of the miraculous and the numinous in the only terminology available to them. Oddly, we moderns have not done much better. It is time we stop thinking of the people of the past as ignorant, as superstitious, as stoned temple priests high on alkaloid fumes and druggy daydreams. They fought wars. They built monuments. They left behind their art and their literature and, yes, their science. Their math and their physics, astronomy and medicine, were populated by gods and demons, by angels and jinn. And yet they still were able to build the pyramids and the henges using this crazy calculus of consciousness and desire. We can learn from them. In fact, we must. Evil people, as well as good, have attempted, since time immemorial, to exploit this knowledge. And you have heard some of this here already. There was an Operation Paperclip. There were secret weapons under development at the slave labor labs of Nazi Germany. And there was more, much more. The facts are as astonishing and as entertaining as any fabrication,
and we promise to tell you all as this project continues to unfold. When you start to learn about the nonfiction version of these events, which represents my own contribution to this project, you will remember aspects of this novel, and you will begin to realize what we are doing, what an enormous undertaking this represents. You will also sense a challenge, a charge to confront this subject in a new way, an active way, an approach that combines scientific inquiry with artistic sensitivity, such that it never has been contemplated before, at least not since the Renaissance. More than anything else, though, you will feel the passion and the excitement that we feel. It's contagious, to be sure. You will start to see what we see, maybe even feel what we feel, and you will never be the same. Peter Lavenda, 2016. This concludes Secret Machines Book 1 by Tom DeLong and A.J. Hartley. Narrated by Paul Costanzo. Copyright 2016 by Tom DeLong. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with To the Stars Incorporated and was produced in the year 2016 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright there too. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.